Well, I take exception to that.
If we keep up with that pattern, if we keep up with that pattern, we will have a huge crisis, because just like a credit card bill, the balance goes up every year we do not fully pay off our debt. We have not been paying off our debt over the past 10-plus years, and therefore that balance has been going up. We have got to stop doing that. And it's not just talking about plan design. I think Act 120 gave us a new plan that we can actually work with in terms of design for employees moving forward. What we need to do is pay that bill that we didn't pay for the past 10 years, we haven't paid adequately. If we do that, if we find a way to do that that doesn't burden the taxpayers, we are going to have a solution to this problem. What I've promised is I'm not going to kick that can down the road.
Governor Corbett, 1 minute rebuttal to that.
I'm surprised, because we're actually talking the same thing. We're disagreeing on how to do it. Because I'm looking at budgets growing. I'm looking at the cost of the budget growing because of health care, because of Medicaid, because of contracts that we have in Pennsylvania, and just the cost of business continues to grow. And we have revenues growing. But I have yet to see any country that has grown its economy by taxing. So I guess I'm inquisitive as to where Mr. Wolf wants to spend the money, how much he wants to spend, and how is he going to get the revenue. I heard him say 9.9% is too high. We agree. We agree. And I think everybody in this room agrees. And in fact, I think we could be attracting a lot more business coming to Pennsylvania if we could lower that, just like we're about to eliminate the capital stock and franchise tax, just like we eliminated the inheritance tax on the family farm and the family business. That's the start. But you have to control your spending first.
You can see all of that debate and others from around the country on our website at cspan.org. And you can look for the most recent debates every Sunday, beginning at noon Eastern, here on C-SPAN. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin recently joined Kansas Senator Pat Roberts at a rally in support of his bid for re-election in November. Senator Roberts was elected to the Senate in 1996. He currently is serving his third term. This event is 15 minutes.
I am absolutely delighted to get to be here. And the senator and I out there on the porch, we just got in our first real argument. I'm telling him how happy I am to be here, and we are just so proud of him and the great work that he's done all these years and that he's going to keep doing, not just for Kansas, but for the rest of America. And he said, well, you know, I'm ranked as the fourth most conservative senator. I said, no, you're not. You're third. So I thought it was four. No, you're third. We're going back and forth. He is a conservative, and he is what America needs. And I know that I know I'm supposed to be kind of Kansas-centric right now, okay? But I'm talking about all of America. I'm talking about the need to have fighters there in the Senate who will fight like our country's future depends on it, because it does. And we have a senator right here who is tried, tested, and true, and bleeding that purple, too. Bleeding that K-State purple. And no question where he stands, and I am so thankful that he proved that a year ago today and last night. He, one of the few senators fulfilling campaign promises, doing what the American people asked him to do, standing there on the floor with Senator Ted Cruz to do what they could to get rid of Obamacare, fulfilling his promise. I love it that he's not wishy-washy on the fence like you-know-who, the other guy. I am so thankful, because we need those with that stiff spine, with the principles that are so convicted within them that they know they'll pick a side. And he's obviously picked the right side all these years. So he, as a warrior there with Senator Cruz, Senator Mike Lee, and those others who said, you know, I'll probably get a little bit clobbered for what I'm going to do tonight and that morning. I'm sure that was probably going through his mind. And welcome to my world, if you think you're going to get clobbered by the press especially. But He did it anyway because he was doing the right thing. That harkens to once a Marine, always a Marine. He knows the fight. My son in the Army, he told me, never say that in public again. Mom, you don't know how to pronounce it. I'm like, okay, hoorah for Marines, hoorah for Army. No, it's really, really good to be in Kansas, or as Barack Obama would say, flyover country. But here it is that you're growing our food, you're helping feed America, you're sending good young folks to the United States military to fight for your independence. It's here that you're raising children with a strong work ethic. And it's here where you can re-elect someone who will fight for the freedom to make sure that that work ethic is rewarded. That's what built this most wonderful, most exceptional country, was that expectation of reward for hard work. I think of Kansas, and that's what I think of. I think of hard work and farmers. I think of those who are unpretentious and have for so long been able to work as a community united, especially in tough times. Our country's going through tough times, and now is the time that we need to be united. After the primary's over, time to get it together. And Kansas, we're counting on you to get it together and making sure that the independents, those who are not registered in either party, that they understand that if you want someone with principles, with values, those virtues that I'm sure he gained in the Marine Corps, but if you want that, you don't have to be stuck with someone who is wishy-washy, but you've got that person there already in the Senate. For unity's efforts, for the reason of unity, knowing that united will stand. Kansas, a lot of countries' eyes are on you today and in the next 41 days, making sure that you make the right decision. We need to be united. Only united, this country will stand. He will help do that. Here in Independence, I know a little bit about kind of going rogue and being independent. I do. And my husband, Todd, I've never even convinced him to register in the Republican Party. He's independent because he says, I just don't want to get involved in all the machinery there in a political party. I just want people to do what's right. Our daughter Piper, her middle name is Indy, I-N-D-I, for independence. And it means something to me. I know it means something to you, something grand, something important. The independent spirit that has to translate, though, into something tangible when you're talking politics. You can't just claim, as Greg Orman claims, to be able to not pick a side and still be effective. That defies common sense. Granted, common sense, it's an endangered species in D.C., but we know that you, full of common sense, you know what it's going to take for America to be saved, and that is that Republican Party being strong there for you. So with that, our good senator here, who is, he's pro-Anwar, pro-life, pro-gun. He's got a lot of bitter clingers and wingers around here, don't you? Well, I'm proud to be with him. He's on the right side of the issues for America and for our independence. And again, as for his opponent, I know independence. And anybody with a liberal record like Greg's, supporting Barack Obama, supporting Obamacare, supporting amnesty, supporting Harry Reid, that's not independent. That's someone who's trying to schnooker you, Kansas, into thinking that he can have it both ways. No, it doesn't work that way in politics, in D.C. especially. No, your senator, he knows what he's doing. We need him back there. We thank him for his service to our country in more ways than one. He is the right man for Kansas and for America. So with that, let's hear from Senator. And we are so extremely proud to get to be here. And good, bad, or ugly, we're supporting you. I know that Kansas will do the right thing and send you back to D.C. for all of us.
Thank you. I just told the governor I think I'm just going to read this speech again. It'd be all right. But at any rate, Governor, we're going to bottle you. That message needs to be sent loud and clear all throughout this election. If you just could show a little more enthusiasm. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to come and listen to a true, grassroots, courageous Republican. The governor is extremely courageous because she says what's on our hearts and minds. And when we talk to one another in our living rooms, at home, in meetings, with personal friends, it's always, how's come? How's come this? How's come our country is on the wrong direction? How's come we're leading from behind and getting into all this problem with voids filled with bad people? How's come we have an $18 trillion debt? How's come Obamacare is raising our premiums and now we can find doctors so the doctor-patient relationship is endangered? How's come we are really allowing people to come across our border during a time of crisis when we have terrorists that are threatening us? Our intelligence shows that they've made many, many threats. How's come we have a country where we're now worried that this country that we honor, we cherish, we love, is now endangered? May not be the country for our kids and grandkids. That is the biggest issue. No, there's one more. That is the biggest issue because we worry about the yoke of big government, more spending, more regulations. I had one farmer out west told me, Pat, I don't feel governed, I feel ruled. And that's exactly what people are thinking about. Governor, I offer to you the statement that people are losing faith in our government. That's a terrible thing. It's an egregious thing. And turn it around is because our government does not have faith in us. That's really what this is all about. That's what President Obama is all about. Government knows best. Well, I got to tell you, folks, not on my watch. That's not going to stand. The reason the governor is here is that the Republican Party is united. United. Every square inch of the Republican Party knows what's at stake. We have to take the Senate back as a first step to turning our country around to Kansas values as opposed to what's going on in Washington. Have to do it. There is only one person on the ballot that will go to Washington and kick Harry Reid out as opposed to giving him a stamp of approval and change the direction of the country with the United States Senate in Republican hands so we can come back to the Constitution, come back to the foundation of our country that made our country great, celebrate hard work. Celebrate Independent Kansas and what we're all about here in Southeast Kansas and the greatest state of the nation. That's what we're going to do. That is why Sarah is here. Pardon me. The governor's here. Pardon me. Mama Grizzly is here. Have you ever seen a Mama Grizzly dressed as a wildcat? You wouldn't be able to kick a field goal, would you? Sorry. Sorry about that. We're all sorry about that. I make a promise to you. I have fought for you before. I have fought in virtually every issue that you care about with regards to agriculture. If you get into crop insurance, we can get into all of the vagaries of farm program policy, and then everybody back there would just phase out. But I know what you do. I know what you do. You are producers. You're hard workers. We produce the food for our country in the very troubled and hungry world. Show me a nation that cannot feed itself and you have utter chaos. That's what we're about. It's pretty damn important. And I will be in the trenches fighting for you. I will be supporting your conservative values. I will never give up. Marines take the hill. I'm going to take the hill and win. My opponent, Greg Orman, says he's an independent. Well, goodness knows everybody likes to be independent once in a while. But you're not an independent if you give thousands of dollars to Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and, yes, Harry Reid. You're not an independent. Wait on it. Wait on it. Wait on it. You're not an independent when you run against me in 2008 as a Democrat. Okay? He is not an independent. He will be a stamp of approval for Harry Reid and a continuation of the Obama agenda. That's not going to happen. Winston Churchill said that kites fly highest in the strongest of winds. There are a lot of winds blowing, contrary to our best interest in the world and in this country. We're going to change that around, I promise you. Thank you so much for coming. Let's go to work. Each and every one of you, every phone call you make, every conversation you make, every bumper sticker you put on, every sign you put on, you're part of a wave to take this country back. Let's get started. God bless Semper Fi. Thank you. One other thing. As the person who crawled through the barbed wire fence, one more point and I'm through. All right? That's a terrible, terrible joke. Hey, we're going to go flip pancakes. Let's go have some. All right? Thank you.
Our campaign 2014 debate coverage continues live on C-SPAN. Tuesday night at 9 Eastern for the final Texas governor's debate between State Senator Democrat Wendy Davis and State Attorney General Republican Greg Abbott, and live Thursday night at 8 Eastern, the Oklahoma governor's debate between State Representative Democrat Joe Dorman and the incumbent governor Republican Mary Fallon. Also at 8 on C-SPAN 2, watch the Nebraska governor's debate between Democrat Chuck Hassebrook and Republican Pete Ricketts. C-SPAN's Campaign 2014, more than 100 debates for the control of Congress.
Next, a look ahead to the 2016 presidential race and speculation about former Florida Governor Jeb Bush possibly running. From this morning's Washington Journal.
Well, Politico's Ben White writes the following. It is now or never for Jeb Bush. The former Florida governor flirted with a presidential run in 2008 and 2012, but ultimately demurred. Always the flickering possibility of mounting a campaign down the road. But at 61 years old, the second son of former President George Herbert Walker Bush is now likely facing his last shot at the White House. Ben White sent out this tweet just a short while ago, about to join C-SPAN to talk Jeb Bush in 2016. If you're up, he's joining us live on the phone. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So how serious is this?
I think it's very serious. I think he is close to a decision. As I wrote in the piece, probably comes after the midterms. I think on the issues, he would very much like to run as a person who thinks he could present leadership to the country. I think he would very much like to run. I think there are serious personal considerations at play here, how it would impact his family. His wife is not keen on his running. She's never been someone who enjoyed the political spotlight. He's also, a grandfather three times over, as his potential opponent, Hillary Clinton, is now a grandmother, and I think he'd appreciate how much fun it is to spend time with the grandkids. So he needs to make a decision whether his passion for the issues, his belief that he could provide leadership to the Republican Party, outweighs a lot of family concerns, and he needs to decide if he has the passion to do it. If he does it, it's going to be a tough race in the primaries for him, be challenging. He needs to go all in. I thought it was interesting, that article you mentioned earlier about his getting in shape and losing weight. Somebody told me in the reporting for the piece, which didn't make it in there, but they said, look, if you see him losing weight and getting fit, I would move the odds more towards a run, because that's something he needs to do. He needs to be in political fighting trim to get out there and really mix it up. So I'd nudge the odds a little bit more in the direction of a Jeb run. I'd say maybe 60-40 that he goes.
Ben, we often hear the phrase the Republican establishment, and I want to first ask you, is there such a thing? And I mention that because with Mitt Romney and Chris Christie all being talked about as potential candidates in 2016, somebody that the so-called Republican establishment could line up in support of. What's your assessment of all of that?
There is such a thing. It's less of a powerhouse than it was before, given the Tea Party revolution that we've seen, a younger generation of Republicans who don't feel that they are beholden to anyone in the so-called establishment. But it would be those in the Chamber of Commerce and on Wall Street and elsewhere who are fiscal conservatives and, social conservatives to a degree, but less so, more focused on the fiscal issues and, like to legislate and get things done rather than have ideological purity tests. And that, as you mentioned, that establishment has sort of nominated the presidential candidate in the past, Mitt Romney being one of them. George W. Bush, followed by, John McCain, who was not the establishment when he ran against Bush, but then was in 08. So Jeb, very much fits into that mold, and I think would want to be the, he wouldn't call himself the establishment candidate. He would call himself, the best Republican candidate to win in the general election. But I think one big question surrounding all of this is, is 2016 the year where movement conservatives, Tea Party conservatives, just throw off the establishment and say, we want to nominate one of our own? You say they can't win in the general. We'll go ahead and find out about that. And can anybody who's the so-called establishment, like Jeb or Chris Christie, ultimately get the nomination away from somebody like Rand Paul or Ted Cruz? So we'll see how that plays out. But Jeb obviously would come out of that mold of the establishment, has a ton of backing on Wall Street, in the Chamber of Commerce types around the country. Whether he can actually parlay that into a nomination remains to be seen.
The other headline on this Sunday morning, this from the Washington Post at the Value Voters Conference, where Senator Ted Cruz winning in the straw poll, followed by Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon from Maryland, and coming in third was Mike Huckabee. This, of course, the core Tea Party conservative component of the Republican Party, Ben White. But let me ask you about the other factor when you hear about Jeb Bush, and that is Bush fatigue.
Yeah. Yes, a serious concern that he's well aware of, that it'll be a knock against him in both the primary and potentially the general. And, I see it whenever I write a story about Jeb Bush. There's immediate visceral reaction on Twitter and elsewhere. No more Bushes, not another Bush. And he's aware that if he were to run, he'll have to very quickly make it clear to people that he is not in the mold of his brother. He's not in the mold of his father. He is his own man with his own ideas on education, on immigration, on the economy, and sell people on Jeb, the person, and the ideas, and get them beyond this notion that it's just another Bush. And I think he could probably do that. Anybody who's followed him closely knows that he is a guy of serious policy ideas and of serious leadership and vision. Disagree with it, if you will, but I don't think he'll come across as, hey, this is just another Bush. Will it be a detriment to him throughout a campaign? Sure. But those people who will say not another Bush probably wouldn't have voted for a Bush in the first place. And the rest who may be on the fence, I think he thinks he can sway with his ideas and his policies. And a lot of people I talked to said to me at some point he's going to have to make a clear break from George W. Bush in a single speech or appearance, whether it's on Iraq or some other set of issues. He's going to have to make it clear to people that this would not be any kind of continuation of the George W. Bush White House. George W. is sort of popular now, but everyone will remember when he left office, he had terribly low approval ratings. So that's something he'll have to do. It's a concern. I think that's not the thing that'll keep him out of a race.
Ben White, we will look for your reporting online at Politico.com. Thanks very much for joining us on this Sunday.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
On the next Washington Journal, Thomas Sanderson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies will discuss the threat that ISIS and other Islamic extremist groups pose to the U.S. and its allies. Salam El-Mariati, president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, talks about the impact the U.S.-led fight against ISIS is having on Muslim Americans. And we continue our conversation on public policy issues that impact higher education with Dr. Mark Schlissel, president of the University of Michigan. As always, we'll take your calls, and you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Washington Journal, live at 7 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN. Tomorrow night, we'll have a conversation with Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Politico's Mike Allen about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Gates is the co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which earlier this month pledged $50 million to fight the deadly virus. The conversation airs tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern here on C-SPAN.
Here are just a few of the comments we've recently received from our viewers.
I find C-SPAN to be very educational for me in regards to the Seven Revolutions, especially currently what's going on with disease and climate and conflict in our global society. I find it very rewarding, and I appreciate all your efforts. Please continue to do so. So I have reliable information that I can go to when I do my projects for school.
I wish you would concentrate on areas that are really important to people, such as Obamacare, the people that have been hurt by it, the people that have been helped by it, and items like minimum wage. The difference between the cost of living in various states, how people feel about immigration and unemployment, and as I mentioned before, tax reform. What are some of the major loopholes? What are the possibilities? Let people know these about these important issues to them before they go to the polls so they can make informed decisions.
C-SPAN. The reason why I like you so much when Congress is not out is because you have greater historical and international programming on your station.
And continue to let us know what you think about the programs you're watching. Call us at 202-626-3400. Email us at comments@cspan.org. Or you can send us a tweet at C-SPAN, hashtag comments. Join the C-SPAN conversation. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter.
Monday night on The Communicators, Federal Trade Commissioner Maureen Olhausen on net neutrality, privacy, and data security.
Big data is a tool, and it can be used well, and it can be used poorly. There are many benefits that can come from big data, consumer benefits. I think there'll be great new insights in certain areas, well, many areas, but some that are top of mind for me are in healthcare, other kinds of research in reaching underserved populations, in providing new insights, I think, in some of our more difficult-to-solve problems that we face as a society. But are there risks from big data as well? I think that's true. I think that you can take pieces, previously kind of separate pieces of information, and assemble them into a profile that may give sensitive insights into a consumer. And the question for me is, You have all these benefits and you have some risks. What do you do then?
Monday night at 8 Eastern on The Communicators on C-SPAN 2.
Tonight on C-SPAN, Q&A with journalist Sally Quinn. That's followed by British Labour Party leader Ed Miliband speaking about the party's agenda leading into the UK's general election in 2015. And then a look at the recent attention the NFL has received over cases of domestic violence.
This week on Q&A, our guest is Sally Quinn, founding editor and columnist for On Faith and FaithStreet.com, a blog for The Washington Post. She talks about her career as a columnist for The Washington Post, as a television journalist, and her change from being an atheist to someone of faith. She also talks about her long marriage to former Washington Post editor Ben Bradley and her personal story in caring for him during his battle with Alzheimer's.
Sally Quinn, on January the 19th of this year, you wrote, "When I started On Faith over 7 years ago, I was an atheist." Let me stop there and ask you, why did you start it, and why did you start with, this wasn't your first column or anything, but why do you say you were an atheist?
I have been an atheist most of my life, and I became an atheist when I was about four. I had always been taught to say my prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. But my father was in the military, and he was in Germany during World War II, and he liberated Dachau. And he had the staff photographer take photographs of these Holocaust victims. And he made scrapbooks out of them, which are now at the Holocaust Museum. And he brought them home. And I looked at these photographs, and I thought, there can't be a God, because how could a God let this happen? And that's when I stopped believing in God. And I didn't even know the word atheist. I just knew that I didn't believe in God. And then I learned the word atheist when I was 13 and announced to my father that that I was an atheist, and he went completely crazy. But even on his deathbed, he and I was with him when he died, and one of the last things he said to me is, "Please don't be an atheist." But you know, I could never explain to him. I mean, he was there. He saw what happened at Dachau, but he couldn't understand how I could not believe in a God. But when I took over On Faith, when I started On Faith, I had absolutely no particular faith or beliefs, or I was pretty much an angry atheist, actually. I mean, I was really mad at God, even though I didn't believe in God. But I was really mad that this person, this thing, this idea that people worshipped could create so much suffering on Earth. And by the way, as of today, I have still yet to hear anybody who is religious explain to me in a way that makes sense why there is suffering on Earth. If there's a God, if there's an all-powerful, all-knowing God, how could there possibly, all-loving God, how could there possibly be suffering? So that's always been a problem for me. But John Meacham, who's a great friend of mine, a religion scholar, and I have had many debates about this. And about the time that I started the website, Meacham and I were talking, we were having lunch, and he was saying, "You know, you're really not an atheist." And I said, "Oh, yes, I really am." And sort of at the end of 3 hours, he said, "I'll tell you why you're not an atheist, because you are not a negative person. And being an atheist is negative. It's you're against something. You don't believe in something. It's not a positive thing." And he said, "Also, you know absolutely nothing about religion. If you're going to call yourself an atheist, then you should go out and learn something about religion, become a religion scholar, and then you can come back at it and say, 'Okay, I read all this, I know, you know, and I'm an atheist.' Then I would respect your position more." And so about that time, you know, I've always been really interested in religion, because it was so clear to me that there are all these people out there who 95% of the people on this planet believe in something, in God. Their lives are completely, informed by what they believe. And a lot of really intelligent people I know are believers as well. So I couldn't dismiss that. And also, it became clear to me that what was going on in the world, not only in politics, national politics, but also foreign policy, so much of that was about religion. And so I wrote an email to our editor then and said, we really need to cover this. But I was looking at it as a journalist. We're just not covering the story. This is a great story. And so he wasn't interested. And then I went to Don Graham. I had lunch with Don, who was then the owner of the Post. And I said, we're not covering religion. He said, okay, you start a website then. And I said, Don, I don't know anything about religion. I don't know anything about the web. I can barely do my email. And he said, well, nobody's perfect. You do it. So I called up John Meacham and asked him if he would. He was editor of Newsweek at the time. And I said, will you do this with me? Because I had no street cred, in that. So we got a bunch of people to agree to be panelists, and we started the site 8 years ago. And then I began to study religion. I took a trip around the world about 6 or 8 months after I started the site called The Great Faiths. And we went to 13 countries and studied every possible religion you can imagine. It was a 3-week trip, totally exhausting. But I was absolutely riveted by what I learned. And I realized that I didn't know anything. That was the first thing that I realized, which was really helpful. And now, 8 years later, I really know that I don't know anything about religion. The more I learn about it, the more I study about it, the more I realize I haven't even begun to understand. But I decided then that I was no longer an atheist after I had studied religion, because I thought Meacham is right. I now understand what people are after. But I also I saw things in religion that were really good. And I had always, my position as an angry atheist was, which was, religion is the cause of all evil. And obviously that's true on some level. Religion is the cause of a lot of evil. I mean, we look at ISIS today and we see that that's the cause of a lot of evil, and other religions too. But I also began to separate out institutional religion from spirituality or belief. And that was a really important time for me. And I'm not alone, by the way. About 25% of the population now would call themselves spiritual but not religious, SBNRs, what I call SBNRs. Actually, Sam Harris has just written a book called Spirituality Without Religion. That there is something there. There's a Dutch movement called the Somethingists, which actually describes my religious beliefs better than anything else. They believe that there's something there, but they don't know what it is. And so I think I'm a Somethingist. I believe that there is something there, and I can call it God if I want to, or I can call it whatever. But I believe that there's something bigger than we are. I believe that we were created by something. And I don't have a personal relationship with God. And I don't really believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. I believe that Jesus Christ was a great man. But I have felt and have been in the presence of the transcendent too many times not to feel that there is something there. And so I don't really pray, but I meditate. I meditate a lot.
Something you were involved in. It was on CNN. Your labyrinth. First of all, what is a labyrinth?
Well, a labyrinth is not a maze. Actually, it's a round flat surface that's shaped. It looks like a maze, but in fact, when you walk the path of the labyrinth, which is supposedly the circuits of the brain. You walk the path of the labyrinth that leads you into a circle, and in the center of the circle is when you meditate, where you meditate. And when you walk into the labyrinth, you think of something, you concentrate on something, an issue, something that's bothering you, that worries you, or something where you need clarity, and that's what I find I get from the labyrinth.
Was this on CNN or was it on the website?
It was on CNN.
Let's watch. It was okay. 45 seconds so people mm-hmm. can. This is at your home down in St. Mary's,
yes.
Maryland. Okay,
yes.
Let's watch.
You don't have to believe in anything or anyone or any god or many gods. All you have to do is meditate about things that are important to you. When you walk the labyrinth, you usually concentrate on something. Think of a problem or an issue or a question. And then you walk around until you get to the center, and at the center, you concentrate some more on whatever it is that you want to resolve, whatever problem it is. I had the most extraordinary experience that I've ever had in my entire life. They were life-changing experiences. And what it was moments of clarity. I walk the labyrinth every single day that I'm here. I'm really religious about it. This is a sacred place for me.
So has anybody said to you, or either behind your back, Sally's lost it? I mean, you know what I'm talking about. They see the spiritualism. They say, oh, that's not really religion. And what's she doing? Used to be a hard-bitten style section writer here in town, or that was The View. What's your reaction to
that? Well, actually, the person who was most surprised was my husband.
You say in this column I wrote that he is religious.
He is. He believes in God. But he doesn't. He doesn't go to church. I mean, he's not a practicing. But in really scary moments, he has prayed. When our son Quinn, we thought was dying, when he'd had a heart surgery, Ben went and prayed in church. I tried to pray at the Children's Hospital at the chapel, and I just went in there, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. I just got no solace, no nothing.
But something does happen on the labyrinth.
Yes, it's interesting. And sometimes it's transcendent. And, you're supposed to follow, as I said, the circuits of the brain. And so, but there's something that happens when I walk the labyrinth. You know, they have them in hospitals now and outside of churches everywhere in the country. And there's something very peaceful and soothing and quieting about it. But I never walk the labyrinth that I don't come away with some sense of clarity or understanding about what it is that I'm going through, some issue that I'm going through, or something that I need to work out. I mean, it doesn't always solve the problem, but I always feel that there's something guiding me.
Catch us up. You wrote for the Washington Post, the style section, for how many years?
Well, it's this year it'll be 46 years.
But I mean the stretch when you were doing hard reporting.
Yeah. Let's see. It was about, I went back after my son Quinn went away to boarding school. He was very learning disabled, and so I stayed at home during that time, although I was still writing for the paper. I guess it's been about 10 years since I was actually on the staff writing. I still write for the paper, but I'm not on the staff writing.
When did you, what happened when you said, besides the story you told about religion, what happened that all of a sudden you wanted to leave this other kind of reporting and go to religion?
Well, it was mainly, I had sort of done it, Brian. I've been there, done that. I'd written all the profiles I wanted to write. I just felt like I was sort of spinning my wheels. I was doing the same kind of thing all the time. And, I actually got off on a tangent about terrorism after 9/11. I did an awful lot of Homeland Security stuff, and that was fascinating to me. I did that for about a year and a half. But it was clear I wanted to move in another direction. I just didn't want to do what I'd been doing. I didn't want to really cover politics anymore. I was interested in politics, but that's not what I wanted to write about.
I want to connect all this to politics, the religious part of it. Here's a clip of the Dalai Lama just recently on the floor of the Senate giving the prayer and then walking around. Let's just watch this and you connect this for us and what it means.
This is my favorite prayer. Daily I pray this. That gives me inner strength. So enthusiasm to serve sentient being, a humanity on this one. As long as space remains, and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain and help dispel the misery of the world. Thank you.
Harry Reid brought him down to the floor, and you'll see here that he walks around and he introduced it. What role does this, you think, really play? How much of this is show in politics and how much of it's real?
I think a lot of that is show. The Dalai Lama, I've met him several times, and he is a very gentle, sweet man. And I think that he would probably be much happier somewhere in a cave meditating. And that's, I think, where he should be. And I'm afraid that sometimes he's being exploited by being dragged around and sort of having to do this fight for Tibet thing. I mean, Tibet, there is no more Tibet. Tibet is over, and that's not happening. And so I think that, you know, all these places he goes and he sits out and talks to people, and he's very difficult to understand. So most of the time people don't understand what he's saying. And, you know, his message is wonderful, which is love and peace and all of that. But, I just feel that he's being used and that people not only use him, but they use him for their own benefit. So I'm not particularly moved by that. I also have a problem with, I care very deeply about the separation of church and state. And so, you know, I have a problem with words like God being used in the Pledge of Allegiance or being used when you're swearing in somebody in the military or whatever. I don't think that has a place in our country now because of religious freedom and because there's so many people who are not religious. It just seems to me that we're no longer a Christian nation. And it seems to me, and we're not necessarily a religious nation. I mean, a lot of people are very religious, but there are an awful lot of people who are, again, it's the same ratio between those who are religious and not. About 25% are people call themselves nones, N-O-N-E-S, which means if you're asked what is your faith, you say none. It doesn't mean that they are spiritual. You know, most people who say they're nuns are people who believe in God or believe in something, believe that there is some higher power. Only about 3 or 4% of people are really hardcore atheists. And even sometimes atheists will say they believe in God.
Why do politicians always close their speeches with God bless America?
They have to. They have to because, you know, the majority of people in this country believe in God, or at least they say they do. And that has become kind of it's become a way of a code word for saying I'm a good person. And, I mean, I have some very close friends who are atheists who are probably some of the most decent human beings I've ever known in my life. Believing in God, and we've seen this from an awful lot of people who believe in God and do terrible things, believing in God has nothing to do with goodness, nothing, or integrity or decency or values or morals. You don't need to believe in God to have morals or values. But in this country, we think that we do. And so politicians are smart enough to know that they have to say that. It's just a ritual. But it means nothing. Most of them, I think, don't even think about it. Or a lot of them aren't religious. But you can't run for office in this country without saying that you're religious. And you probably ought to be a Christian, too. And so, you know, I think that we have a black president, we'll have a woman president, we'll have a Jewish president, we'll have a Muslim president, we'll have a gay president before we ever have an atheist president. Because I just think it's too scary for a lot of people to even contemplate. Although I think that the religious four horsemen, you know, Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and Sam Harris, have done a lot to dispel the myth of the evil atheist. They've made it acceptable for people to say that they don't believe in God. But Joe Lieberman was Jewish, but I think Joe is an Orthodox Jew, and so he was a practicing, and you know, he's part of the Abrahamic faiths, and people respected his religiosity, or, well, I should probably say his religious faith, his religious nature. And so I think that that was not necessarily a detriment for him because he was religious and talked about how important his religion was to him.
How often do you write?
I try to write once a week, sometimes twice a week. I mean, once every 2 weeks. And I write for my website on faith, and then that will run in the Washington Post on the religion page. And then occasionally I'll do something that's not about religion that just strikes me as something I want to write about.
And it's on the website, and if people want to read you, how do they find it?
They go to On Faith. They Google On Faith.
Just On Faith?
Yeah. FaithStreet.com/On Faith.
I want to go back. I remember that I have a piece here that you wrote in 1974. And what I want you to do is compare this town with what it was then and what it is now. And this is a piece you did on somebody named Steve Martindale.
Yes.
Been dead for years. When you did a piece on him, he was 30 years old, and he died 16 years later of AIDS. Who was he, and why did this piece, most of them haven't read it. It was a huge piece. I mean, it went on for, you had two full big pages of it. But it had a real impact on the city, and what were you trying to do?
Well, Steve Martindale actually was a very sweet guy. What I was trying to do was show how you make it in Washington, how you make it socially. And Steve was this rocket, you know. He'd come here out of college, and by the time he was 30, he was having parties with the most elite, the most famous, the most powerful people in Washington. How did this happen? He was very personable, very friendly, and I liked him. But what I wanted to show was how it works. And what Steve did was that he became friends, and he was out everywhere. He started inviting people. He would go out. He would make friends. He would cultivate people. He would flatter people. And then he would start having these, and I still never sure who paid for these parties, but he was able to put on these events. And I think one of the things I said was his trick was to call up Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, and say, I'm having a party for Henry Kissinger. And then he would call Henry Kissinger and say, I'm having a party for Alice Roosevelt Longworth. And they would both show up. And everybody knew that if Steve invited them to parties, everyone would be there. And so he became the sort of host with the most in Washington. But it was a fascinating phenomenon to me to see how the power elite could be had so easily in Washington. And you ask how it has changed. Honestly, I don't think that part of it has changed that much in terms of how you succeed. But I think that just having parties in general has become so much more difficult because there is this sort of rancor in Washington. In those days, Republicans and Democrats actually spoke to each other. They were actually friends. And I think a lot of that was because people lived here. Most people on the Hill lived in Washington and their families lived here. They would go off to their home states and campaign on the weekends or once a month, depending on how far away they live. And then they would come back here. So they saw each other at dinner, and they saw each other on the weekends, and their kids went to schools together, and they went to church together and synagogue together. And so there was a real sense of community here. And then I once wrote that the airplane was the demise of you know, friendship on Capitol Hill, because once air travel became so much easier, people started traveling. Now most families live outside of Washington, and the members of Congress will fly in on Monday, spend Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights on their sofas or live in group houses and then fly home on Thursday.
I think one of the things I noticed is that almost everybody you wrote about in here, almost everybody, with the exception, I think, of Henry Kissinger and your husband, Ben Bradley, are dead. And I want to show you an interview was done about 20-some years ago. This man is dead, but he is mentioned in your piece a lot. And he had a lot of visibility back during the Vietnam War. Let's take a look at this.
What about the power of a columnist when you were doing that business? Did you feel that
no
power?
No columnist has any power at all. They always think they do, but they don't. If you act as a transmission belt for facts that have an impact, you can have an impact as a transmission belt. But the idea that anyone in the United States is foolish enough to think the way they do because some damn columnist thinks that way in the morning paper is an idea that only a columnist could believe.
When we were together with an interview back in 1997 on your book, The Party, you did a pretty good imitation of Joseph Alsop. Is there an explain the Alsop character, and he wrote a column in The Post, and The Post was owned by the Grahams and all that. What's changed?
Well, first of all, Joe actually believed that he had a lot of power, and he didn't believe that he was just a transmission. And he used his power, and columnists still do have power because people are afraid of them because they do have an impact, and they do have an impact on what people believe, especially if they're good and if they're well-respected. I mean, if you're someone like David Ignatius at the Washington Post, you have a lot of power because people actually change the way they behave in government or the way they act or their views because of what David writes. And many of my friends, columnists, have the same impact. So, and Joe knew perfectly well that
we see this so often where somebody says exactly the opposite of what they believe. Why would he do that?
He was a contrarian. You know, he liked to shock people and he liked to take the other side. But I don't think that part has changed. I mean, he was very powerful. And also his proximity to the Washington Post and his friendship with the Grahams made him even more powerful.
So what do you really think of the Post being sold?
Well, I think that Don Graham had no choice but to sell the Washington Post because the Post was losing money. And he sold it to save it. And I think it was just an incredibly courageous thing for him to do.
What's it do to the town that it's now owned by Jeff Bezos? It's also run by a former Reaganite.
Yeah. It was very hard for people at the paper when Don sold it. I mean, everybody was kind of in shock, although we saw it coming because we knew the numbers. And they just couldn't. It was better to sell it than to have to fold it, which is the direction it was going. Jeff Bezos bought the paper, and Catherine Weymouth, Don's niece, was publisher until a month ago. And she's now stepping down, and so there are no more Grahams involved. And he's hired Fred Ryan to be the new publisher, who is a former Reaganite, but he's not, he's not a wild-eyed ideologue. You know, he's not... I don't think that Fred Ryan will have any, I don't think he's going to impose himself on the news gathering operation at all. I don't think he will. I think he's going to be someone, and I think he was a good choice because people were nervous about Bezos living in Seattle and not being here. And, you know, once the Grahams left, you really did need someone who had been in Washington. Ryan has been here for 20 years. He knows the news business. He has a real respect for the newspaper and the role the newspaper has played. So I think he'll be a great ambassador to Washington.
You felt the power of this town when you wrote these pieces in the Post. Do you still feel the power when you write your religion column? And it's only on the web, mostly?
Well, it's so different now because being on the web, I mean, I was in television for a while. I was the first network anchor woman in America when I did the CBS Morning News.
Careful, we have a clip to show
you. Oh, dear. This was not my best moment.